counsel.
Louis Gordon and David Gardner for the petitioner. May it please the court. The first point.
One of you going to argue? Or?
Yes, sir.
You can sit at the table if you like. Yeah.
The first point I would like to address, Your Honor, is the CAT claim, which I believe the board is clearly wrong on. Pursuant to Camalthus in this circuit, CAT is a separate analytical claim, and the board did not mention CAT in its decision. There was a motion to remand. The Department of Homeland Security had said in its brief that the CAT motion was late filed, which is not true according to the regs. There was no final order of removal when that motion to reopen was filed, and the petitioner was not ordered removed. He was granted voluntary departure. So I believe it's very clear that our first point, that the case has to be remanded for CAT, is secure based on the regs and the law in the circuit. The second point that I would like to take up is,
if we were to do that, what happens to the balance of the case?
Well, those issues
just go back to the whole thing. Just goes back.
Remain. But I wanted to address that point, which I believe the board is clearly wrong on under the law. The second issue, which is of crucial importance in this case, is your jurisdiction over the 1 year rule, over the 1 year filing deadline. You have jurisdiction to determine if you have jurisdiction. I understand that there is a statutory bar to jurisdiction when the Attorney General makes a ruling on a 1 year deadline. However,
that applies to Mr. I think his name was what was his name?
Gregorian. Yes.
His for Kevin or Kevin.
Yes. However, Karen Gregorian.
Karen.
However, I believe you also have jurisdiction to look at the constitutional issues involved in reaching that final determination, just as pursuant to Kalau, you have jurisdiction to determine the constitutional issues in discretionary.
What's the constitutional issue?
Well, there's a due process issue because the judge did not allow testimony from the petitioner on the reason for the filing after the 1 year deadline. And at that point in time, the regulation had come out. The final regulation had not been enacted. The judge said reluctantly he's going to find he has no jurisdiction to hear the asylum claim, and the BIA summarily dismisses. So we're put in a situation where there is no interpretation to come out except the judge's reluctant decision. As I say, he did not allow testimony on it. The issue was not brought up to the very end of the hearing when government counsel said he's ineligible.
Okay. Well, let's try to move this along because we've used up 4 out of the 10 minutes, and I don't think we ought to use up more than half.
Okay.
On this issue. One question, though, on the bar. Since the hearing, and I think since the briefs, there's been a decision by this court which says the bar doesn't apply to the children. Are you familiar with that decision?
I'm not offhand, Your Honor. That the bar wouldn't apply to his children.
Right.
And, yes.
Would it apply to his wife because she's derivative here? That's what the IJ essentially said.
Well, the IJ found that.
Why would the bar apply to the wife?
Well, she is part of writing in his asylum application. Well,
isn't she entitled to file her own?
She would be entitled to file her own asylum. He's saying that the incidents that occurred at the incidents occurred at a time which would have allowed, which would have required him to file within 1 year. But it's not, there was no development of case law at all on this at that time. And it's unclear. It's, he was making a first level decision at that point in time, kind of a blanket bar. He did not take a lot of evidence on it, and he didn't look very deeply at it. As I said, it came out at
the end. 1 year, does the 1 year bar statute, does it apply to derivative applications?
Pursuant to.
Is there anything in the statute that says it applies to derivative applications?
Okay. Is it written in the statute?
Yes.
I don't believe so.
Is there a regulation that says that it is?
I'm not aware of the regulation.
So then why does it apply to her?
It wouldn't. I would go ahead that it wouldn't apply to her.
We have a case that says it doesn't apply to the children.
I would accept that position, that it wouldn't apply to her.
Didn't the wife and the children file within the 1 year? They filed their own separate asylum
subsequently,
claims.
Yes.
Right, but within the 1 year,
yes.
Right? So why does it apply to them at all?
It wouldn't apply to them at all. But the problem is, at that time, this is one of the very first cases the IJ had heard on the issue, and he made that finding. However, the lead applicant is the applicant
But he could have considered each of the claims individually. He just chose to consolidate them.
Correct.
And having consolidated them, decided that they were all time barred.
Correct. And I would like Mr. Gardner to address
this. Let me ask you one question before you come up, Mr. Gordon. I want to ask you a question. Suppose Mr. Gregorian hadn't filed an application.
Right.
And she files her application, and it's based on time, basically raising the same claims as she is here, sort of predicated on what happened to her husband and her own fear. And her own, because she had some stuff that relates to her,
right.
Her own circumstance. You would agree she could move that right through the system?
Yes, Your Honor.
And point to the circumstances that happened to her.
Yes, Your Honor. That would be a valid claim.
Okay. Is your co-counsel going to
yes.
Be the merits?
I'm sorry. He had done the hearing.
I don't care what he did. I just want to know who's going to argue the. We've now dealt with the procedural
yeah,
question.
He's going to argue the.
He's going to argue the rest of the case.
Yes.
Okay. Because now we're down to the merits of the case and whether there's a. Whether the decision on the. Because the judge went beyond the procedural question.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd just like to quickly address some of the facts, and in particular, insofar as it relates to the.
Okay. Well, you have 2 minutes, but we'll give you maybe an extra two or three because. There's some serious problems on the fact that they ruled against you on the merits.
Your Honor, the immigration judge's decision was primarily based on the fact that no physical injury occurred to the
I didn't think it was primarily on that basis. It seemed to me it was on the basis that this is not a persecution on the account of political opinion. This is a businessman who wants to get the franchises in a country, and it's a country where the leaders of the country want the franchises for themselves. And they don't want him, they don't want to give them to him, and they want him causing trouble with their plans to keep the businesses to themselves, and so they threaten him about that. And what I understood the judge to say is that's not persecution on account of political opinion. It's business persecution of a rival, even though it's the government doing it.
The petitioner's testimony was that he was a trained economist, that he had a Western outlook, and he believed in the a free market economy, and that, in fact, at that time, there was a pretext of privatization in Armenia, but, in fact, it was government-controlled, and therefore he posed a threat because of his beliefs and his approach to business, which was threatening to the government. And therefore the theory of political opinion.
Well, he wasn't trying to reform the system. He was trying to get particular contracts for himself.
That's correct, Your Honor. And as a consequence of doing so, threats were made against him and his family. Someone made a phone call to his wife saying, we'll cut off his head and kidnap your kids.
I wasn't questioning whether there was the conduct was such that would be persecution. It's got to be persecution on account of one of five grounds, like race, religion, political opinion. I'm not questioning at this point whether the conduct was such. If they had done these things to him because he is white, or because he's an American, or because he's black, or because he had a particular religion, then it might well be persecution. All I'm talking about now is what I understand the IJ to be saying. To me, the most significant finding was that all of this may well be persecution, but it's not on account of this person's political opinion. It's because the person wanted the contracts, and they wanted to keep them for themselves because they were corrupt.
If there's shown to be a nexus between the criminal element in society and the government, and a person is trying to exercise his rights in the way we would in a Western society to compete, he poses a threat to the government, his conduct and his beliefs, he forms a social group, whether it's capitalists or persons who
a social group
of persons who believe in a free market economy in a society which doesn't, and therefore he was a minority in that group, and he was in fact threatened because of that, and ongoing threats were made against him and his family. So this it's either imputed political opinion or a social group comprised of persons who believe in a westernized democracy, economic free enterprise system.
Well, I think you could make that kind of an argument if they were persecuting people in general who were opposing their policies. If there were a lot of capitalists running around this country and the government was going after them because they were capitalists, that seems to me somewhat different from going after an individual who's trying to get the same business that the president's wife wants. Or maybe the Secretary of Defense, or whoever it happens to be. That's good old-fashioned capitalistic competition. Now, they may not use nice tactics over there, but it's a question of who gets the business. And when you're in power, in some countries, you get the contracts, or your friends get the contracts.
I understand Your Honor's point, but I think at the history of Armenia at that time, there was a transition, and the government had instituted a privatization program, and the petitioner's argument was that he was probably one of the few people at that time who were advocating a capitalist position. There weren't a lot of people running around bidding. It was government-owned and government-controlled, and therefore his very presence in bringing in Americans to compete in what was a closed bidding society posed itself a threat to the government. That was his argument, and that's his fear. And that's the theory of the case in the context of what was happening in Armenia, and I believe the country conditions do show that corruption was endemic and at this particular point of time continues to be so.
Well, I think this goes on in a lot of the former Soviet Union countries, and a lot of Eastern European Soviet bloc countries. In the conversion to capitalism, they learned some of our bad habits.
The issue, Your Honor, would be in not so much corruption, but as to whether the old system of the KGB and the propensity for violence to people who are opposed to that system, and that depends on the state. Armenia may be different from some of the other states or from Russia itself. And so the country conditions here show that Armenia was particularly, there was an inextricable link between what was described as a mafiocracy, a criminal element, and that anyone who got in their way was either killed or tortured or kidnapped or subject to random violence. So in that context, this becomes a much more serious issue than someone just trying, losing out on a business bid.
So your basic argument is imputed political opinion.
Imputed political opinion and also mixed motive.
Yeah.
And then finally, to join what my co-counsel has argued, that if, assuming Your Honors did not find that there was a particular group, the Convention Against Torture becomes that much more significant because that's an independent form of relief. We're not necessarily looking at persecution, and it should be independently evaluated regardless of whether or not the petitioner belonged to a social group or had a political opinion. It's the likelihood.
And what's the torture? You're talking about, are you saying there was past torture or it's a fear of future torture?
There's a fear of future torture, acquiescence by the government, the link between the government and criminal elements, and that based on the facts here, the series of threats and the seriousness of the threat, that the court at that time did not have enabling regulations to address Convention Against Torture, it would have been a different case. There's a different standard, and therefore the case should, in fact, be remanded to evaluate this evidence or new evidence based on the criteria for, under the Torture Convention, which was not done. There's no record of that because the statute wasn't in effect at the time of the trial.
Thank you, Kent.
Thank you.
Maybe look at it. We're still in the morning, so good morning, Your Honors. My name, again, for the record, is Margaret Newell. I'm here from the Department of Justice on behalf of respondent in this case. Your Honor, just to quickly touch on the asylum claim before we get into the persecution aspects in this case. This court has found, and the statute clearly states, that the court has no jurisdiction to review any decision of the agency under 8 U.S.C. 1158A2. The immigration judge's opinion, which is the opinion being reviewed by this court, is very clearly making a decision. It states specifically that it's making a decision under that 1158A2. And therefore, this court does not have jurisdiction to determine any of the asylum.
Well, I think Mr. Gordon's argument was a little bit different. He said my client was not allowed to testify on the reasons, and that was the denial of his constitutional right, you know, to tell the story.
With respect to that, Your Honor,
wouldn't that be a subject to our?
I do not believe that that argument is supported by the record, and I also believe that there's no prejudice which would be required for a reversal. If you look at page 333 of the record, Petitioner's counsel, after the close of testimony, said he would like an additional opportunity to present testimony. Initially, they just omitted testimony about that. They were not refused to present testimony in the initial presentation of petitioner's testimony. He then asked to begin again to present additional testimony. The judge asked if the counsel had testimony that was different than the reasons proffered in the asylum application, and informed the counsel that the court could decide, taking into account the explanations in the asylum application. And at that point, the petitioner's counsel chose not to pursue taking additional testimony, acquiesced in that, and did not press his request further. So I believe it's not supported by the record. At any rate, the petitioner is not has never come to the court or the board to say that petitioner would have proper testimony that would be different than the asylum application, which was considered by the court in making this decision. So I don't believe there's been any.
Does his untimely petition have any effect on the wife and children?
Yes, Your Honor. The judge found that because the family's asylum applications were derivative of that, depended on that.
No, we just had, the court just issued an opinion in a case called El Hemry versus Ashcroft, where we said that wouldn't affect the children's application.
Well, Your Honor,
why does it affect the mother's application? She filed a timely application in her own right, right?
This Court, unfortunately, does not have jurisdiction to overturn that decision under
the statute. She appealed the denial of asylum, correct? To the BIA.
She did.
All of them appealed the denial of asylum to the BIA. Is that correct?
I believe that's true.
They all petitioned the denial by the BIA to us. Right?
So now
we need to ask. I mean, you don't have jurisdiction to review the asylum determination.
That's correct. And the asylum.
So we need to look. Does the statute, the one-year statute, does that apply in this situation to the mother and to the children? We already said in El Hemry that it doesn't apply to the children. So my question to you is, why does that statute apply to the mother?
Well,
who filed a timely application?
The immigration judge decided that it applied, and that's any decision pursuant to the statute.
Well, let me ask you, what is in the statute, then, that leads you to say that the IJ's decision was correct on that point?
The statute does not specifically address derivative applications, but...
Is there a regulation?
Not specifically to this point, to my knowledge, Your Honor. But
you're saying no matter how incorrect it is, there's no jurisdiction to review it.
I know that's not an easy thing to say to the court, but
we're quite
used
to jurisdictional problems.
Your
Honor. I just want to get the issue clear. That's all.
That's correct.
And you say no matter how wrong, even if the child had an absolute right to do it, and even if the law is that you can't bar him, that if the immigration judge was wrong, there's nothing we could do about it.
That's what Congress decided, and that's what this Court has acknowledged in the Hakim and Molina Estrada cases. Yes.
Well, we have jurisdiction to determine our jurisdiction, don't we?
I don't believe that it's a question of whether the Court has jurisdiction. I mean, if you look at... the courts.
Well, what you're saying is that what you're saying, though, clearly with respect to the male, is that his application was untimely. Therefore, you have no jurisdiction to consider his asylum application. And you're saying to us that because she filed the derivative application, that same one-year time bar applies to her, and therefore, Ninth Circuit, you have no jurisdiction to consider her derivative application. And I asked you, and you gave me a response that, well, the IJ said this, and, there's a statute, but I don't see anything in the statute. I asked if there's a regulation. There's no regulation. We said with respect to minors just recently in a case called El Hemry that bar doesn't apply to minors. So I don't know if it,
Well, Your Honor, I guess my, just to clarify our position, it's that as long as the immigration judge, the agency decision, is clearly making a decision pursuant to that statute, and by that I mean...
He didn't cite the statute. He just said
she
was untimely.
No, I'm sorry. He did cite the statute.
Well, I don't want to take away your time from your merits, but...
Thank you, Adam.
We can both look at the record later.
Could you, looking at your brief, when you quote the statute, it says, no court shall have jurisdiction to review any determination of the Attorney General under paragraph 2.
That's correct.
But I can't tell what paragraph 2 says. What does paragraph 2 say?
Paragraph 2, there's 2B states, actually I'm paraphrasing right now, an alien is not statutorily eligible to apply for asylum unless he files his application within 1 year after he arrives into the United States. The regulations clarify that means the latest arrival in the United States rather than the previous entries. So that would be May 1997 for the lead petitioner. 1158A2D addresses when an untimely filing could be excused by exceptional circumstances or changed circumstances. Your Honor, I would like to proceed to the merits.
All right.
Your Honors. First of all, I will point out that the social group argument that's, that was discussed today, that argument was not raised before the agency, and so, therefore, there's no exhaustion of remedies on that. So I don't believe that's before the Court today yet. To move on to the political opinion, the immigration judge did find that the petitioner failed to meet his burden to prove persecution on account of political opinion, and also found...
Well, the argument of your opposing counsel is that they viewed him as somebody advancing an opposing philosophy. He was a market capitalist or a free market proponent, and he was trying to bring the free market economy to this nation. And that's why they were persecuting him.
That's true, Your Honor. First, I would like to point out for the Court the burdens that this petitioner has in obtaining relief from the immigration judge and also then in review before this Court. Under the withholding relief, this petitioner would have to prove that there was a clear probability of future persecution, which
well,
means more
not,
likely.
Yeah, let's not go into the standards,
okay.
Because you don't have much time.
Right.
Just tell me the answer to the question, the answer to the argument.
Your Honor, the answer is that, as pointed out by the judge, there's no indication in any of these, in the petitioner's testimony about any of these incidents that these alleged persecutors were motivated by any, by his alleged support of a free market system. They were merely, and petitioner admitted in connection to one incident that they were motivated by greed. And the record supports the reasonable finding that these officials or their associates threatened petitioner and harassed him because they just wanted to get these business opportunities for themselves, not on account of any disagreement with his political opinions or to punish him or otherwise affect him because he held some sort of political opinion. They weren't trying to change his political opinion. They weren't trying to make him stop bringing up a political opinion. They were trying to just dissuade him from participating in bids. I contrast this with...
I gather the government had adopted some sort of policy of opening up a private-run business, I mean government-run businesses.
Privatization, yes, Your Honor, that's true. In that period of
time, there was a governmental policy at play.
Right, the governmental policy was to open these types of businesses up to public bid. These individuals who happened to allegedly have influence in that government, whether it's related to their influence in the government or not, wanted to be in on the action. And for that reason, threatened petitioner. And it's interesting as well that when he stopped pursuing those bids, the threats specific to those bids ceased. The only threats that he complains of after certain businesses were awarded to his business rivals related to different businesses, which it appears were then up for bid at that time. So in each case, he was merely threatened to dissuade him from taking advantage of a business opportunity. The court's or the immigration judge's finding that there's no indication of a motivation relating to a political opinion is upheld by the record. I'd also point out that the immigration judge's opinion that the threats and harassment that petitioner complains of did not rise to the level of persecution is supported by substantial evidence. It appears that these incidents that he he describes were more like personal disputes, maybe personal or business disputes, like in the Zayas Marini case in this jurisdiction, or criminal bribes, as in the Bolshakov case.
All right, that, counsel, we're running well over again. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess I would like to, if you wouldn't mind, address the Convention Against Torture issue.
All right, we'll give you a minute for that.
The Respondent does not take the position that the Convention Against Torture...
Did not what?
Does not take the position at this time that the Convention Against Torture reopening would be untimely, not for the reasons stated by Petitioner, but because there was no final order at that time. It was being appealed. But the petition for remand was denied under the broad discretion of the judge, validly, because Petitioner had not stated a prima facie case for relief under the Convention Against Torture, where the court had found there wasn't even a well-founded fear of persecution or treatment that would rise to the level of persecution. Certainly, there was no indication that there would be torture. And the petitioner in this case is relying on the same testimony that supported his withholding of removal claims, aside from one article, new evidence that related to conditions in Russia, which are not material to this case. So for those reasons, and the reasons stated in our brief, unless you have any questions, we'd ask the court to deny.
Thank you, counsel. Case just argued will be submitted. The final case for oral argument is Davtian versus Ashcroft.